Hello, Citizen Stewart listeners. This is Ravi Gupta. Sadly, I'm not joining you for the full episode today because Kate from our team, who is much more knowledgeable and talented than I am, has jumped in to talk about K-12 issues. But before we get to that episode, I need a favor. I never ask you for anything. We don't even bother you guys with advertisements now or anything like that. We're a nonprofit company. The one thing you could do before you even move on to listen to this episode is click on the show notes. We have a link to vote for us. We've been nominated and we're finalists for what's called the Webby Awards, which is kind of like the Oscars of podcasts, under the category of limited series and specials in news and politics for this series that we did on a objective, unbiased history of Israel and Palestine, which was our most popular episode of anything we've ever put out. And you could vote for us. Voting will be taking place over the next 2 days. It closes on Thursday. So you should go do it right now before you listen to the rest of this episode. It takes you less than a minute. You just need to sign in with a Gmail account or anything like that. And you only need to vote for one thing. It means so much to us if you could do that. And it could help bring us over the top in that voting. So with that, let's get to this episode.
Today, we're diving into a hot topic, the debate over the value of a four-year college degree versus career and technical education. Is it classist to try and push more people into career and technical education and to finally admit college is not for everybody? We're going to talk about that on today's Citizen Stewart Show. Welcome to the Citizen Stewart Show, a podcast about education and democracy, where we dive into the top headlines and we add new perspectives about how America educates its young. I am Citizen Stewart.
And I'm Kate Malikoff.
And this is the Citizen Stewart Show. Let's jump right in. So everybody's going to notice that, Ravi, you look really different today, and you probably sound different. So what happened to you, Ravi? How come you look and sound so different right now?
You know, this is what happens when you spend a lot of time surfing. The waves can change you.
Is there like estrogen out in the waves or something? Is that what's going on in the world? I knew that climate change was having an impact. I didn't know that there was, you know, it's probably the plastics, right? I don't know enough about this, but yeah, it's probably the plastics in the water. How are you?
I'm good. I'm good. How are you, Chris? It sounds like you've had a crazy week.
You know, I did have a crazy week last week. You know, it'll be very boring for my listeners to know that, you know, I had a big board meeting last week that really makes you feel like you're adulting when you have to prepare for a board meeting. Oh my God, look at me. I'm so fancy. I'm, you know, preparing for a board meeting and I'm going to facilitate and all that. I don't care how old you are. You never lose that sense of being young in those situations, I don't think. Like, you know, imposter syndrome can hit you at all ages. So, and Kate, you know, I know, like, I've met a version of Kate multiple times. I've met a version of you multiple times. People who are, I think, taking on really big projects like you at the Branch Media, Romy Drucker, who is one of the founders at the 74. I remember the first time I met her, I walked in and sat down with my founder and her and Campbell Brown, who was her founder at the time. And I remember when I left, I said to the founder of my organization, I said, she's going to eat everybody's lunch. And I didn't mean Campbell Brown. I meant Romy Drucker. I like pointed it out the first time I met her. I looked at her. I sized her up from shoes to her head and listened to her talk. And I said, she is going to eat everybody's lunch. And I just wish I had put some money on it because I recognize talent. And she did. She ate everybody's lunch. So Kate, what that has to do with you is you're exactly the same situation, right? You know, so to everybody's Ravi, there's a Kate. To everybody's Campbell Brown, there's a Romy. To my founder, there was a me, but I don't put myself in the same category as you guys because you're so organized. Like you get so much done. I don't know where that comes from. Like, is there a gene? Like, what in you makes you this, like, it must be an organization gene that I didn't get.
I don't know about that, Chris. Any comparison to Romy Drucker is a compliment, so I'll take that. But I wouldn't say, I think you've got a few unanswered emails waiting to hear back from me, so I'll keep working on my organization, Gene.
Well, you're building an empire. You're building a whole thing. And, you know, I'm happy to see it. I'm really happy that we're in good hands. I love being on the Branch Media Network and the show. Let's jump into news. What's up in the news right now? What's happening?
Yeah, well, Chris, I want to talk about the news that's in your life. You were invited by who you called your nemesis to Tim Pool's show. So after a crazy board, prepping for a board meeting, which can make for a crazy week, you joined the culture war to discuss school choice, among other topics. And you wrote this great piece I just told you earlier today about not only what you talked about, but the experience of choosing to go on a show with someone you know you disagree with. So tell us a little bit more about that.
Yeah. So I just got a message out of the blue asking me if I wanted to be on Tim Pool's show. And anybody listening, Tim Pool is like one of the most famous people you've never heard of. In his, I don't know what you call it, the manosphere, like the Andrew Tate type people or whatnot. Dude's got like a big following, millions of followers on social media and on YouTube. So the idea that I was being invited seemed a little random and weird to me because it's a very right of center show, for one, to the right of me by far. And two, how would you know me? Like, you know, this feels weird. This feels like a setup. And I happen to know that there's a good number of people on the right side of the fence right now that would love my cancellation. So I figured that it quite possibly was a setup, like I was going to be ambushed. And then I found out Corey DeAngelis was going to be the other guest. And I was like, okay. So Corey and I have not been friendly for a long time, especially since I dropped out of the school choice cult. Actually, I've been persona non grata, and he is seen as like one of the biggest stars on that side of the fence, like, you know, the biggest rising star. He's been on Fox News. So here I'm thinking, I'm going to go sit with Tim Pool and Corey DeAngelis in an undisclosed location. Felt like a setup, but I went anyways. This is a testament to people like when you get offered to go into the lion's den and you really want to test your mettle, go. Just do it. So I did. The piece you're talking about just kind of like was me making notes of like what happened and how it all went down. It turns out it's in this really rural place where like I wasn't so sure about where I was going. I didn't know what this felt a little weird, felt like a setup. You know, I think I did something, Kate, though, that I'm good at, which is I don't have enemies. Like the people who can disagree with me the most have an open invitation to be on my show, right? Like the ones who violently hate me have an open invitation to still come. I mean, we can still sit down and we can talk. Some of them can't do that with me, but I can do it with them. And if you're listening to this and you want to test that and you feel like you're a person who so disagrees with me or whatnot, test it. You'll be on the show. So anyways, did that surprise you at all? You read it and did it surprise you that I would go to Tim Pool's?
You know, and our listeners should read, and now I've got to watch the show, but they should read the piece you wrote. I'm sure we'll put it in the show notes. But as I was reading it, Chris, I thought, and this is exactly why we wanted Chris to have a show on The Branch, because one of my favorite sayings is strong opinions loosely held. And what I think that means is you are someone who I think is very good at saying, I've got a strong opinion about something, and I'm open to having my mind changed or to making sure that I can dig deeper into why my opinion is so strongly held. And so I think there aren't many people who would say, all right, I'm going to go to what sounds like the middle of nowhere with someone that I know I disagree with, and not just disagree, but publicly disagree with, and engage in another conversation. And not, you know, you were coming to their turf. This was not a, you're going to get to dunk on people who disagree with you. So I have to say, I wasn't surprised. I just felt like congratulating you and Ravi for saying, we need the Citizen Stort Show on The Branch. But what I was, yeah. Well, but Chris, so what I want to ask you, what I was left thinking about is you talk a lot about your, how, you know, you and Corey in particular, Corey DeAngelis, who we also did an episode with on Lost Debate, you know, you had similar opinions. Now you have very different opinions. And I would argue some different values driving those opinions. But you get in the car with Corey and he shares some personal news. He's expecting his first baby and you get to see the human side to him, which we lose when we're on Twitter. I think that actually makes it harder to have disagreements with people when you are looking at them and you are thinking about them as an individual. And sometimes I have found myself walking away from conversations where I actually think disagreeing would be really important because we would learn a lot. And so I'm curious, how did you feel like you could stay in actually having a really constructive conversation where you could both learn a lot when you were doing it from, you know, in front of the computer screen as opposed to behind it?
Yeah, you know, you probably know this, like when you're behind the keyboard, everything is not personal, right? It's depersonalized. So you can really just think the worst of people and go off on them. You get in the car with Corey, first thing I notice is his wife is with him and she's a lovely person and he's very caring and attentive to her. You can see it in the way that they behave with each other immediately. Like there's a lot of kind of just like love and compassion between the two of them. And then they tell me they're expecting a baby, right? Like, and baby news is like one of my favorite things. You know, I think anybody listening to the show long enough knows that I really want grandchildren and I'm not getting any. And I love baby news. And I love like when men become fathers. It's like one of my favorite things because I think we should be more supportive of each other when we know one of us is going to have a baby. So I just felt immediately like, Corey, this is about to be like the best time of your life, man. Enjoy this. Like this is, so now that I'm thinking that, I'm not thinking about all the stuff we disagree with, right? Like, yeah, we can still disagree. I still think you're very wrong. I think he's dangerous. He thinks that I am like just out of touch. Like I've lost it, you know, my street cred on the school choice side. That's all well and good, but the dude's about to have a baby and, you know, but I will say this to you to be very honest, like super honest about this. I feel like I could do that with just about anybody, but there have been a few people that I've met that are pretty famous that actually absolutely treated me as a person in their care where I would never want to talk to them again, right? And I'm thinking about one or two people that if I said their name, everybody knows them. They're famous people who are in this game and they're really famous. They have big platforms and big names and they are just miserable people. Like they treat staff terrible. They treat, you know, workers terrible. They treat drivers terrible. And when you're in their company, you feel like you're an inch tall and they let you know that you're an inch tall. So it's easier with someone like Corey. He's young, he's bright, he's smart, he's engaged in ideas, and he's about to have the most loving time of his life versus like one of those other situations where I probably would not be as easy to work with. So long-winded answer, but yeah, it was cool. It was cool. And Tim himself, Tim Pool, is very intense. Like he's very intense. And they cornered me. I'll welcome everybody. Go listen. Go watch it. Go see it. You'll see it in the show notes. You can go see it and watch it for yourself. I did not win. It was something where points mattered. I did not win. I was definitely on their turf. And I was like, I was the foil. I was there to be the foil. So, and I was.
I think you won by going. So, but I'll have to check it out and listen to confirm. So
I appreciate that. Thank you.
Well, so you went from Tim Pool show to then, as we were talking about what we wanted to talk about on the show, to someone who is famous. I don't know if you have met this famous person or not, but J.K. Rowling recently came out again to criticize Harry Potter stars Daniel Radcliffe and Emma Watson for their support of trans rights after the NHS released a study on gender affirming care for young people. I'm curious, this fissure in the Harry Potter universe has been going on for a few years now. What do you think the role is of what Rowling called celebrity mouthpieces for their stance and what the impact is of them speaking out on this issue at all?
So first, let me ask you, are you a Harry Potter person?
Harry Potter took me from being in remedial learning to advanced learning in a year. So I owe a lot to Harry Potter.
So you've read the books?
I have read the books.
Those big things. So years ago, my oldest, they read all the books, those thick books that sit on the shelf now. My younger kids won't pick them up to save their lives. They're too thick. They're too big. They find them boring. You know, they've been social media, whatever, corrupted. But I remember I couldn't read them, but I remember how fascinated my kids were with those books and they read them. And I remember thinking, God, she's got a great story. The story I heard was that, you know, on the way to work every day in an office, she was writing this stuff down on a note or something. And now she's a billionaire, right? Like, what a great story that is. Why? It's so weird to me that you would go that far in life and then you would make your issue the kind of like the over-indexing on talking about a group of people that make up like 2% of the world's population, right? And that you would just go hard on it. Like, it seems so weird. So I asked Tim Pool this too, because they brought the trans thing up and they all share the same talking points. And I was like, guys, does it seem weird to you that maybe 2 or 3 years ago, no one mentioned this? And then all of a sudden, none of you guys can shut up about this group of people? Like, what happened in 1 year where all of a sudden everybody started like, you know, this became their issue? So when I look at somebody like her, she has too big of a platform and too much money to be using her outsized kind of influence on this group of people. Why? I would even ask you, like, does this even make sense for someone like her to make this their issue? She's a Hollywood person. She's accusing Daniel Radcliffe and Emma Watson for being kind of, I don't know what you would call it. I mean, she's accusing them of basically being a little bit kind of flighty and getting involved in things that they don't know enough about. And they should just maybe like, kind of like the Laura Ingraham thing, like just shut up and dribble. She's kind of like saying to them, just shut up and act. But I feel that way about her. I feel like you should shut up. Maybe just go enjoy your money. You've got so much money. Just go get on a boat somewhere, you know, and go do whatever people do with your amount of money do. I just can't get the fascination. And then, you know, what's driving this for our listeners, you should know. there's a study that came out called the CAS study, National Institute of Health or Sciences, I don't know what it is. They put out a study on gender-affirming care written by the same woman who wrote some of Florida's rationale pieces for why we should attack gender-affirming care. So it's not like it's coming from an honest source. But when it came out, all of the right wing jumped on it because it basically said, we don't know enough about gender-affirming care to keep pushing it, to keep promoting it, letting it happen. Anyways, I feel like some of us just have to be social justice warriors. Like they're forcing me, you know, a former libertarian, they're forcing me to become woke. Like, I think I just have to claim it. Like, I'm woke as hell now. Like, I'm woke Mick Woster. I am the like president of Wokistan right now. And I don't mind it. I actually like my new position as president of Wokistan, you know, because if woke means looking at a group of people who make up 2% of the population getting beat up on constantly and standing up for them, standing between them and their bullies, then call me woke. I just want to invite my listeners to be woke too. Let's be woke together, right? Like, just let's have a woke off.
A woke off. You heard it here first, folks. You heard it here first. We are changing the name of the show. This is the Wokistan Show. And Chris is taking over. It sounds like a dictatorship, but one that we could get behind.
I think you should get behind it because, I mean, like, help me, rein me in. Am I going too far when I say that I actually don't believe there's validity to that side at all? I just don't think it's valid.
Yeah, that is my gut reaction on this topic and I think on similar topics. I think where I struggle is I would love for celebrities to be quiet until they speak up about the things that I believe in. And then I'm really happy that they spoke up because it's shining a light on something that hasn't gotten enough attention. And so then I have to think about whether or not I'm a hypocrite who just wants everyone to believe what I believe. I think in the case of J.K. Rowling, clearly this is a topic she's very passionate about. I'm not sure I fully understand why. It certainly doesn't seem aligned with a lot of the lessons that I learned from her books. But there's a great article in New York Magazine from maybe a month or two ago from Jonathan Chait. But there's an article in New York Magazine looking at the Free Press, who did an entire podcast series on J.K. Rowling and her advocacy around this topic. And at the end of the article, he says something like, building a worldview entirely in reactions to the excess of one side is eventually cooperating in the excesses of the other. And I think that is what has happened with J.K. Rowling, is that she was so triggered by the responses to some of what she had to say when she first talked about this issue, that she has become a warrior. When I don't know, I think, you know, some of her first comments were to say, I don't think I understand what this is. And for me, Chris, that's where I think about your visit to Tim Pool. Is it my job, especially as a white woman, to say, well, screw you? Or is it my job to say, what is it that you're concerned by? I don't understand this issue. I was around people who identify as trans as a kid. And so to me, it's just sort of they're another person and I've never had to think much more about it. But that is where I struggle, is how much is it my responsibility actually to engage so that people don't just feel like, well, I'm going to be singled out anyway, so I'm going to get more extreme, versus joining Wokistan.
You have an open invitation to come to Wokistan, just so you know. And I get what you're saying. There used to be this saying that a conservative is a liberal that's been mugged. And so you have a liberal person and then they bump into something that, you know, that hurts them, or they really disagree with, and all of a sudden they're Ann Coulter, or they're, you know, Candace Owens, or keep naming the list of people that once used to be more moderate. Now all of a sudden they're like holy culture warriors on the other side. So there is that. There's also this thing, if you think about history, is that there were just people that were right and wrong throughout all of history. If you were on the side of women's suffrage, you were on the right side. There was no other side. And congratulations, everybody today is better off for that being happening. Now, you can go back then and probably find people that were mealy-mouthed about it. You know, well, maybe we should give them, you know, like a right to vote every other year. Or, you know, maybe you're asking a little too much. It's a little too soon. Like, right, you know, for women to be voting. It's a little too soon for that, you know. And even some of the leaders, the white leaders, white women leaders of the suffrage were like, okay, black men, maybe it's a little too early for you. Let us white women get it first. And then there's a number of those. And they were always wrong. They weren't right then and they're not right now. And I appreciate the people that I read about in history that were super clear about it then. Slavery is wrong. denying women the right to vote is wrong, right? Like just calling things what they were. And right now, I would hope that in future, I'm one of those people who are saying like singling out this group of people for medical bigotry and trying to create what kids in school used to grossly call a game of smear the queer. I don't know if you're old enough to remember this as a game. You don't? Yeah. So in the 70s and 80s, there was a game that schoolyard kids would play called smear the queer. And basically what it meant was one person would be identified as the person for everybody to run after and throw on the ground and beat up. And you would be that person. Our producer is saying it was the 90s and the 2000s. He's younger than me. So the game probably lived on for a period of time. And, you know, you would yell smear the queer and that person would start running and then everybody would run after that person and then try and catch them. And that person would run for their life, right? Like, because once you catch them, you throw them on the ground, you beat them up. The game was called Smear the Queer. And we didn't know that that's even what it meant. We didn't even know that like the queer part was like, you know, what people would yell when they go after, you know, gay people. I think about that sometimes when we think about this fight that we're in for trans people. It's a game of Smear the Queer and we should not run along. We should actually run right near the person that's being attacked and stand up for them. So anyways, I'm sure I said too much about this. I think J.K. Rowling should stick to writing and whatever she does now, living off the dividends of her billions. And she should stop attacking groups that she knows nothing about. And so should everybody else, right? Like, I just wish everybody would mind their business. I will say this to you. I asked Tim this because he brought it up. I asked him, I said, Tim, if I go home right now and I found out that one of my kids actually is trans, who do you think should make the decisions about what I do from that point on? Like, because I'm going to start having a plan of action. I'm going to start needing to check into some things as a parent. And I know how I am. So tell me, who should make that decision? He says, there's no answer to that. That's an unanswerable question. And I'm like, okay, but you guys are about parents' rights for everything else except for this. In this one situation, you want me to have no rights to be able to plan out the course of action. Interesting. So anyways, that's my final word on J.K. Rowling.
Yeah, I think the one thing I'd say, Chris, I'm shaking my head, which is not helpful on a podcast, but I think that there is a way to say, I think your thoughts are wrong. I don't think this is okay. And I'm not going to tell you you're a loser because I still want to have a conversation with you because I want to have hope that you can change your mind. And I think that there is a place for people who are not so close to the issue, right? I am not a trans person. I feel like I can say, I believe in trans rights. I think we need to leave these people alone. But I'm not going to tell you that you suck. I'm just going to say, I want to keep talking about this with you. Mm-hmm. I think, I don't know, maybe that's sort of the Obama hope era. But I think it is really important to continue to try to get people to change their minds, especially if it's a topic that you can put the time and energy into working on.
And I think it depends on how aggressive they are.
For sure.
I think sometimes they're so aggressive to where it's just like, you know, it's not even a discussion. They're just like trying to hammer you into the ground and, you know, own the libs. And, you know, at that point, you're just kind of like, okay, well, first of all, I'm not a lib, but, you know, whatever. I am the president of Wokistan. Yeah, I'm the president of Wokistan. So there you go. What's next? What else is in the news these days?
Yeah, well, Chris, you shared this fact with me. In 2021, a group of researchers published the results of a wide-ranging experiment looking at the hiring practices of leading employers. And they submitted over 83,000 fake job applications for 11,000 entry-level positions at 100 of the largest U.S. companies. They sent in nearly identical sets of applications with names that were, in quotes, distinctly Black or distinctively white, as well as names that were gendered. And they found a lot of discrimination as a result of that experiment. Tell us a little bit more about their findings.
So, you know, this becomes one of those things where you go out and you do an investigation. I used to do it in a lot of cities all the time, what they called audits. So they would send out testers to a group of people that had identical credentials, and they would send them into one field or another to see, like, you know, if there would be a difference in how they were treated. And of course, spoiler alert, yes, every time they do that, they find that there is a difference interacting in the public. I do want to go back to Tim Pool because I want to keep, you know, milking this for all that I can. Tim said to me, what's your definition of racism? Because he said that it was racist for us to have affinity groups in schools. And I said, I don't think that's racism. He's like, oh, well, you know, isn't racism just dividing people by race? And I was like, yeah, that's not my definition. And he's like, well, what's your definition? And I started talking about structural things that the United States has a hierarchy of racists. that were established a long time ago. And the totem of races have different experiences within the systems, our major systems. And that becomes systemic. I don't care about individual racism. I care about systemic racism. He says, you made all that up. You just made up that definition. I'm looking at the Oxford definition right now, and it's mine. And I was like, okay, well, did you read all of the definition or whatever, right? So anyways, there's a definition for racism to him and to others that we should, you know, think about. The term is also applied to political, economic, and legal institutions and systems that engage in or perpetuate discrimination on the basis of race, or otherwise reinforce racial inequalities in wealth, income, education, healthcare, civil rights, and other areas. So I'm just pointing that out for people to stop always focusing on individual racism. Am I a good person? Am I a bad person? Am I racist? And realize that when you have a difference of response rate in something like the job market, because you have a black name, that's a systemic difference that is causing a lot of people to earn less and then to have less wealth. And then that creates gaps, like systemic gaps. That's because we don't pay attention enough. This is why we don't want CRT. We don't want a tool that helps us understand where in the systems this is taking place. Yet this particular study and others keep proving that there's a different experience that we are having when we do things like apply for a job. So in this group, what was it we said? They sent 83,000 fake job interviews to 11,000 entry-level positions. Now, I would think that that's a pretty good scientific number to work with, right? I would think that's a lot of, you know, that's a big study. And they found, like, you know, by sending names that are distinctively black. Now, I won't put that in air quotes because I want to know what's a distinctively black name necessarily. I don't want to get hung up on this, but there are other names that are distinctively white. My name is Christopher Stewart. So what would my name be? Is it distinctively white?
I don't know. I'm Catherine Ann. You tell me.
Yeah, I don't know. So, but anyways, they found out that when they used distinctively black names, that there was a lower rate of interest in those, even when they had the exact same credentials and background, which kind of flies in the face of this whole meritocracy thing that we're always arguing about. But I just want to point out, not just to point out this one study. This has happened in this study, but it also happened in Long Island, for instance. They did a major study like this, and you can look it up on Newsday. It's called Dividing Lines, Visible and Invisible. And they sent a whole bunch of people out into the real estate market that had the same credentials. And in the Long Island real estate market, they had very different responses to places that were available or weren't available. Suddenly you show up to a place and they're like, oh yeah, we just sold it. You know, that sort of thing when they see that you're black. So anyways, my whole opinion about this right now is when we talk about anti-racism, we are not talking about stopping individual people from saying racial slurs. We're talking about the differences in wealth that are created by the differences in our systems that have nothing to do with merit. They have nothing to do with effort or working hard or your family structure. My family structure has nothing to do with me being offered bogus loans when I have the same credentials as a white person, and then that happening in a larger scale, like in big numbers. That's systemic racism. I think people who benefit from it the most are the ones who deny that it exists the most. So when I hear somebody say, that's, you know, the blah, 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 that doesn't exist, I really assume that they benefit from it being that way. And why would you want to give up a benefit? Anyways, that's my speech for Wokistan today. The three topics today that had me all like going back to Wokey McWoster. I think I'm going to change my Twitter handle soon to Wokey McWoster. Anyways, what's our main topic today? What are we going to talk about? We want to talk about college, right? So this is becoming really important to me because I did a TikTok saying, I don't know when it started that we started discounting the importance of college and discounting what it can actually do. I thought we were all on the same page that college actually leads to a wage premium, meaning for every year that you go to college, you actually earn more in your life. And if you go to college for 4 years, the distance between you and a college earner, or a high school earner, excuse me, is pretty profound, right? I thought we were all in agreement about that. Now, there's always been the strain of, yeah, but not everybody's going to go to college, or not everybody's college material, or yeah, but there should be some other pathways besides college. And that's where career and technical education has always come in, CTE, career and technical education. I don't know if people know this, but career and technical education, the law that established that as a offering in the United States is actually older than compulsory education. So the career in technical education began in 1911, right? So this is a long-standing American thing. A lot of your uncles, fathers, grandfathers, great-grandparents or whatnot actually were on the track for having really good lives based upon career in technical, what used to be called vocational education. There's a lot of great things about it. Career in technical education is associated, especially with Black kids. Actually, they do better in all other subjects when you put them in CTE. So they're in career in technical education, and you think, oh, that's vocational. That's just a voc thing. No, but they end up doing better in the other subjects too, like in reading and math and the other subjects. I don't know why. Maybe it's because the hands-on basis of doing something that is more project-based, but it still requires math and reading. You still have to read to do it, and you still have to do math to do it. Maybe that's what makes the lessons that you teach relevant in the other classes. But I'm on the fence, Kate. This is where I'm on the fence of. We absolutely need more kids in poverty, more kids in low-income families, more kids whose family never went to college. We need more of them to actually become college graduates. Because every time they do, they actually become bigger earners. And every time they become bigger earners, they create critical mass of earners in their populations, like in their groups, right? Black communities need Black doctors. They need Black accountants. They need Black bankers. They need, you know, everything that you need to have a good society. You need it. They also need plumbers and mechanics. And I dare anybody to try and find a four-year degree that you can get that makes as much as a mechanic or a plumber after 2 years that is as cost-effective. Right. Like as cost effective as those programs are. What would you say is your take about the dividing line between I want to be a pro college person. I also want to be a pro CTE person. I'm fearing that one group of people, when you say CTE, they get put on this lower expectation track, right? Like it's a lowered expectation thing. But the reality is some of them do end up making a lot of money. What do you think? What do you think? How do I split that baby, right? Like I want to be for both.
Oh man. You know, you sent me this topic last night and I was immediately reminded, I don't know, Chris, if you had to do this in school, but in middle school, I went to school in Ohio. Our school was still doing tracking curriculum. So you're sort of assessed by late middle school where you think you'll be, and then you can choose your classes based on the likelihood of what people think your future will look like. And my career assessment actually said that I should be a plumber. And everyone got the results. And I remember standing in the hallway with all of my friends, and some of them are going to be philosophers, and some of them are going to be managers, whatever that means. And I'm looking at this and I'm like laughing that I'm going to be a plumber. Spoiler alert, I'm not a plumber. Could probably use some of those skills, but I'm not. But I think, Chris, this question for me is really wrapped up in the stigma of some of the jobs that you might be more likely to take with CTE and really interrogating the value of a college degree. And I am really torn on the topic. I worked in HR in schools and nonprofits for a long time. I can tell you that probably 90% of the roles that I hired for really didn't matter whether or not someone had a college degree, but we were much more likely to pick up their resume if they were, especially because we were at a school and the mindset there was all of our kids need to think that they're going to college. But now we've got a whole generation in debt because they did. And so I'm left actually really not sure what to do with this news other than to wonder, is Gen Z now going into this trade because college is so expensive, or are they going into this because they see more opportunities to do work that they can get more passionate about?
And, you know, for people who want to know kind of where I was getting this from, you know, it was in a back room chatter group that we have. There's this article in the Wall Street Journal right now that how Gen Z is becoming the tool belt generation. When I first read that, I was like, they're not. I was like, this is like another one of those things where I love when people popularize an idea or a thought or a trend. Oh my God, phones are making everybody depressed and we should get rid of them. Oh my God, this, you know, look at the correlation between such and such. And, you know, it becomes that kind of like Freakonomics thing where years later it all gets debunked or, you know, it gets, you know, you get told that it wasn't what it is. I'm not saying that this is one of those, but this thing about Gen Z are all going into the trades now, I had some initial cynicism. But when you look at some of the numbers that they have in this piece, if you look between 2019 and 2023, the vocational focused community college enrollment goes up in starting in 20 It just starts going up and it goes up, up and up. And then in 22, it gets another boost and it separates from the number of them that are going to four-year institutions and to community college, which I think is really, you know, interesting. It's still 20%, you know, it's like below 20%. So it's not like it's everybody, but the trajectory from the beginning of the pandemic. Now, I wonder if the pandemic gave a lot of people like a chance to look at their tax bill or their like their student loan bill, I'm sorry, and really have some misgivings about what they were doing with their life. And subsequently, so did other people. Like other people who are, you know, sort of saying, I actually don't know about this whole college thing, which is sad to me because I do know about the college thing. I lived for years without a college degree and I can tell you what it looks like in terms of jobs. Somebody just sent me a job today. It basically straight up says we would prefer a four-year degree. When you see that as a job hunter who doesn't have a four-year degree, you know what that means. That means this is a red strike. I'm done, right? There are some people that are complete morons who have that credential who actually will be interviewed for that same job that you're just not going to interview for. So anyways, I want to say where another part of my cynicism is coming from. Years ago, I used to work for the state of Minnesota, and we tried to get more people into careers that took 2 years to get into. It was easier with things like network, you know, networking stuff, administrator, network administrator, you know, tech type things. But we took them out to the railroad. And the railroad is having a major retirement situation where they're going to have all these jobs available. They start between $70,000 and $80,000 a year with very minimal training. Like you just have to go through a two-year college program, but I don't even think it's 2 years. I think it's less than that. And we took young people to go look at that. And we're like, man, you know, you could get paid $70,000 or $80,000 a year. You know, we're thinking like from the hood, that's really big money, you know? They looked at that job and they said, yeah, but I would have to do that shit. Right? So it's kind of like, they were like, yeah, you know, you should pay a lot of money for that because I'm not doing it. Like, I don't know what made you think I was going to do that job. But that's the part where I feel like we might be a little bit unrealistic in that. I don't think everybody is like the I want to work with my hands group of people. I think a lot of our people do want to be in air-conditioned rooms, you know, sitting around philosophizing and thinking about things, you know, the way that a lot of us do for a living now. Now, you're not Gen Z, so you're not becoming an elder yourself. Do you think that it would be easier now to sell this to the next generation than it was for your generation or, you know, about the same?
Good question. I think my hope is that instead of worrying about what we are selling when we have kids who are 13, 14, 15, and 16, that we are selling people on the idea that you can make a change in the middle of your adult life and that we have created more paths to make a change in the middle of your adult life. I think that often a college degree makes it easier to make those changes. So I think that's where my argument gets a little challenging. But, you know, I think about when I worked in HR at a school, I had two members of our operations teams. And so this was two people who worked primarily with our families. So they would focus on student enrollment. They would focus on really anything that a kid was doing that was not happening specifically in the classroom. This team was focused on. I think they are often the unsung heroes of many schools. And they were both in their late 20s and they came to me and said they were leaving. And they actually were becoming, one was becoming a plumber and one was becoming an electrician because they both were starting families. And over the next 5 years, they could make much more money in those two professions than they were going to make if they remained in a school. And providing for their family and being able to buy a house, which they've both done, was much more important at that stage in their life. I think that says a lot about how much we need to pay people in schools, but also they were able to make that choice. What I wonder about is if in 10 years they then say, I want to go do something else, have we set up our society to allow them to continue to be curious about what they might want to do next and what might serve them best at that stage of their life?
I think that's like a super profound insight. Actually, America should have like an idea about lifelong learning. Maybe you want to switch and do something, right? And I think the first things that people think about are the friction between you and making that decision. Like, how much is it going to cost? How often, you know, would I be able to go? How long is it going to take me? There's all these questions that we should make really easy to answer. Like if we really care about being an efficient country and getting people to where they need to be, hey man, maybe I've been, you know, maybe I'm 38 years old, maybe I'm 42, I'm done with what I've been doing. how can I quickly transform into something else? There's a good reason too. I will say I'm looking at this article from them. There's going to become like a problem with some of our industries if they don't think of a way. First of all, we know this about teachers. We need to get more people into teaching. And right now, I don't think anybody's cracked the code on making that happen. As a matter of fact, most of the teachers I'm talking about, I want to keep saying this. We said it in last week's show, but I want to keep saying this. Most of the teachers I'm talking to right now are sick of you guys. I just want to be, people listening to this, I just want to let you know, they're sick of you. They're sick of parents. They're sick of your badass kids. They're sick of like their work day. Now, they won't tell you what I'm saying right now because they do love their occupation. They love their job. They love their profession. They love everything about it except for us. Like if it wasn't for kids and parents, it would be a great job. Like teaching would be a fantastic job if it wasn't for parents and kids. And it's getting worse for them. That's why many of them are contemplating. I just talked to a star teacher today, star teacher, who told me that for the first time, it really does look attractive to switch into something like what we're talking about right now. Something else that doesn't. Well, we should make it easy. Maybe not for teachers because we need them to keep teaching. But for everybody else, we should make it easier to switch occupations.
I hope this is not your stance for Wokistan. You're going to lose a lot of followers.
Did I just lose a bunch of people? Like, we need to make it easy for everybody but teachers to switch careers and go into something else. The thing that I was going to say about like we're going to be in trouble if we don't, there's going to be a worker shortage that is talked about in this article here. There's a shortage of skilled tradespeople brought on by older electricians, plumbers, and welders retiring, and that is driving up the labor cost, which is also creating sticker shock for homeowners when they look for repairs and they need things done. So there's a trickle-down situation happening here, and you're going to start calling for a plumber or something like that, and it's going to start making you think, well, do I really need pipes? Do I really need plumbing in my house? Like, you know, plumbing is like, that might be a luxury at some point if you have to keep paying upwards of what people are paying now. And, you know, I think, like, what does it say? Demand for trade apprenticeships, which helps students kind of combine work experience with the course of study paid for by employers, has boomed lately. So this is like the solution, I think, that gets out of where I'm going to do it, can I do it and work, who's going to pay for it. Those are great questions for states to start answering so that this becomes easier. I'm not sold that Gen Z as a group wants to do this as much, but I like your idea that it shouldn't be just about them. I'm also not sure that I'm sold on all the like AI is changing the whole world and it's going to create a whole bunch of new jobs or whatever, because I'm just old enough to remember multiple of these things that have come and gone. The internet was going to do that for everybody. And, you know, some of the promises of the internet have been met, some haven't been met. Would you still be a plumber today? If you were going to leave the branch media today, like what could be attractive to you if you had to like just think about like, I'm going to do something different. What would be attractive to you right now?
Oh man, I think I do romanticize working with my hands because I've spent the past few years behind a laptop. I would love for us to be in a world where we get away from one job and everyone does a couple of different things, but doesn't have to worry about where their health insurance comes from. If I could spend 20% of my week working directly with kids, I would be in a school 20% of my week. But don't put me in there 100% of the time. I don't have the energy for that right now. So I don't know. I think, you know, I was just listening to a podcast this morning. There was a study that found curiosity is now one of the leading indicators for longevity in someone's life. And so the idea of lifelong learning, I think, is really important. But I think because, you know, we talk about education on this show, Chris, I think that starts with the tone that we set when kids are in first and second grade. I used to host, and schools do this every year right around this time, college to career days, people come in, they talk about their professions. I would put money that 80% of the people coming to those days are bankers, lawyers, and then maybe artists because of the, you know, 2% of people who have made a living doing that work. We can set the tone of what professions we respect every single day. We used to have our kids make sure that we had appreciation days for our facilities team, for our part-time staff. I think that there are other ways to open up the realm of possibilities so that we actually are hearing more from young people about how it is they want to spend their time, and then they can advocate to make it a feasible way to do so.
The number one thing that they want to become is influencers. So when you poll American students, the number one thing that they want to become are influencers. social media influencers, online influencers, the number one thing is not that they want to become tradespeople. There's some tradespeople in my family right now. I look at them and I marvel. They worked for a certain number of years and now they're in retirement. They have a pension. They're living life. They're fishing. They're hunting. They're traveling. They're doing some of the stuff I really want to do. Like they're like, I don't know if this appeals to you at all, but like getting in an RV and just going across the country and seeing like the biggest ball of twine is like something that I would want to do tomorrow. Like that's just something I would do. Like if I could do it, that would be, if there's an occupation of doing that, that's something I would be doing right now. Like that would be my job. But it's because they worked for those years in an occupation that had a pension and that there was a pretty clear defined pathway. You get the job as an apprentice, you get certified, you become part of a union, you work for a number of years, you build things like schools and hospitals and all that. This is the people I'm looking at actually in our family. And then after that, you know, when you're done, like, you know, 55, 56, 57 years old, you start living the rest of your life after that, right? You know, now, like I have a brother-in-law that's his situation and he's doing retirement wrong. He retired and then he picks up other jobs. Like, you know, he still keeps working and it's kind of like, oh man, that's just doing it wrong. I'm supposed to retire and go to Denny's every day. That's like my plan. You know, something we didn't talk about here that I think is important to all this too is gender. It is very hard, for instance, to get young men to go into nursing. The opportunity in nursing is so huge right now. It's like the length of the program to become a nurse and the payoff that you get from being one are disproportionate with each other. Like it's a short enough program that makes you enough money that it should be a stellar option for so many people. But because it's seen as a feminine occupation. Now, I would say also too about this. I was about to say, I don't know when that started. I always thought that nursing was cool or whatnot. No, I kind of remember now that I think, you know, when someone said male nurse, like male nurse, that was kind of like code for something else, you know, like male nurse. Like, why do you have to say male in front of it? It's just a nurse, right? I think we have more than one occupation like that. Teaching is kind of, I think, like one of those. It's considered a highly feminized occupation. Many of the really good opportunities are in what are considered highly feminized occupation. Many women have moved on. I get more women doctors now and judges and whatnot. You don't need as many women paralegals because, you know, some of those are actually going to go on to be at the head of the table of those occupations. What do you think we do about that? Or do we do anything about that?
Man, I don't know, because my immediate thought is that those things are true. And what is also true, for example, is that only, I think, less than 1/3 of the largest 500 school districts in the country are led by women. So we don't have a lot of women in the leadership positions of the occupations that they make up the majority for. And so I think we've got a talent problem on both ends of the spectrum, where women may have more opportunity in those jobs like teachers and nurses. But men who choose to go into them are going to make a lot more money and rise a lot more quickly than the women that they're leading. And I don't know what to do about that challenge.
Why do you think they get more money?
Well, we talked about this a little bit. Chris, I'm about to take over your title for Wogistan. I'm now co-president, unknowingly. This is why you had me on the pod today, right?
You're the Speaker of the House.
There we go. No, I think boys are told that they can be in charge. And so why would they take a job where they are going to have to take direction from others? And of course, we're talking in a binary here, but I think that that is a challenge that I don't blame on men or women. I just blame on our system.
The more we talked about this in the show today, the more unclear I know that I am, but there feels like there's a few national discussions that are talking past each other right now. One of them is, what do we do about boys and men, period? Boys and men are falling behind. They're becoming more angry and hostile and aggressive and lonely and all the things, you know, all the things. Women, the happiest women right now are childless women. Right? Like the happiest women. And, you know, don't fight me, bros, on this. I'm just regurgitating a recent study that came out that said the happiest women are probably near 40 and childless. Meanwhile, we have all these people in the manosphere talking about, oh, you're going to be so upset if you don't have kids and find a man like me. a man like you, a unemployed video game player who's like drinking Mountain Dew all day, you think that's the brass ring here? I think you're going to need to reassess your life and your choices so that you can be worthy of me. But anyways, so there's a discussion about men and boys. What do we do with them? They're dislocated and all that stuff. Oh, poor guys. And then there's this thing around backfilling what were once considered to be, you know, kind of like masculine occupations. And they don't want to do those things, right? So you have a lot of old men that are about to retire. So part of the dislocation of those guys is, you know, I don't know how to say it without being mean, but you're kind of a loser, right? Like, you can't get a date, you can't get married, you don't want to do your grandpa's job, which, and the other conversation I think we should have, and I'm being really flippant about all these things that I say though, is what happens if we don't backfill a lot of the American jobs that keep society running? We have all this kind of like hyper individualized thinking anymore, and people don't see themselves as society builders. All these jobs we're talking about, construction and, you know, electrical. I just remember people used to have pride in doing those jobs because, you know, I have family members that built the Superdome in New Orleans, and every time they drive by it, they know they built the Superdome, right? That like they're societal builders. I think now it's just kind of like individualized stuff. And I don't know what you do about that. Anyways, those are the three conversations I think that need to come together at some point. What do we do about dislocated boys and men, poor babies? What do we do about backfilling the jobs that are critical to us running that nobody wants to do anymore? Sure, it's great if everybody's going to be robotic and AI, but we're still going to need to backfill some of these other occupations. And I think actually the other conversation is, how do we make going to school, going to college frictionless? How do we get all the friction out of the process? For any American that wants to go on to do anything else we need them to, why aren't we making it easy? Super easy. Not University of Phoenix easy. That's a different easy. That's a different type of easy. But just easy in general. All right. Where am I off base? Am I off base anywhere in that? I want you to like really, before we wrap the show, you have a moment to like completely tell me I'm crazy about any of it.
No, Chris, I like to put numbers on things. I think there's a study from the National League of Cities that says local government employment declined by more than 300,000 workers from March 2020 to March 2022. The American Medical Colleges Association says they will have a shortage of up to 124,000 physicians in the next 12 years. And that is also pre-physicians leaving during COVID. And the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics says we will also have an increase of a 9% growth in demand for electricians through 2029. And so I think what you're saying is exactly spot on. The basic tenets of what make society work, not even just what make it good or allow us to live well, the things that allow us to live, the things that allow us to function are in crisis or are going to be in crisis. And I think we have an opportunity to take things like the crisis that we have facing boys and men and think about how do we empower them through some of these challenges? How do we start more mentorship programs? How do we reframe the stigma around some of these roles or some of these challenges to help solve it?
Do you feel fully compassionate about that particular problem?
About boys and men? Oh, yeah.
You do? You feel compassionate to that?
I do. You know, I worked in social work for a long time. I still volunteer as an advocate in New York City's foster care system. And I have had the opportunity to work with a lot of great men and a lot of great fathers. And I see the way that they are treated in some of our systems versus the way that some of the women I work with are treated. I also see all of the ways that men are still given passes. I still sit in meetings where I say something and it's not until a man says it that it is repeated. And so don't you worry. I still have a lot of issues to say on the other side. But I think that for so long, our concerns about men went unanswered, that the pendulum swung. And now it is not cool to say we still have a long way to go in how we treat boys and men. We still have a long way to go in how we talk about what boys and men can think and feel and act. I just refuse to see it as an issue that we can't address at the same time as we address some of the continued dynamics that also hurt women.
Yeah, I think you just lost your street kid in Wokistan.
I'm out. Because I like men?
Well, you know, it's not that you like men, I think is the problem. I just think, you know, for people who write so many books about the coddling of the American mind and write so much stuff about how, you know, like how snowflakish everybody has gotten, you know, these days. But then when they get to like men and boys who look like them, who write these books about the coddling, all of a sudden it just like coddling becomes okay. It just becomes okay. Oh, you poor baby. You just want to play Minecraft all day and drink Mountain Dew, like I said earlier. Oh, wow. And you can't get a date. Okay. Wow. It must be really terrible for you. It must be really awful not being able to get a date while you're in your basement. It just feels a little bit gross and weird to me that we're so mean and hostile to everybody else. But when this group is suddenly feeling like they have boo-boos on their knees, that we all have to like, you know, get real soft on them. Oh my God, we've got such a problem with our boys and men. We need to like do something to help them. Listen, I'm a guy. What you just said is still absolutely true. That, and I know it because if you sit in a meeting next to a woman, that's a really good strategy of looking smart in a room because you just wait for them to say stuff and then you just restate it. And then like you're brilliant. So, you know, my strategy works well, but don't cry for me like when I'm at the head of the table.
I mean, now I'm really coming out as a male justice warrior today. So that's going to be news to many people in my life. I hear you, but I think that's what the loudest voices are saying. But I'm thinking about who's more likely to be in jail? Who's more likely to get thrown out of school? These numbers are still talking about men. And I do think there is a connection between the issues that we're talking about that are more in the coddling world of talking about emotions and feelings and what we, how we treat young men, particularly, I would say, young Black and brown men. And those are the men that I think about when I think about the issues that we need to improve when we think about what we're not doing to support young boys and men. I worked with a dad a couple years ago who was fighting to get custody of his three children, two were his biological children, and one was not. And the barriers thrown his way, if he would say, I think this is stupid, we had a judge end the hearing that day. I never experienced that with any of the mothers that I was working with. And so I think the people who are leading the conversation on the crisis, quote unquote, facing boys and men are not as concerned about the issues that I think are actually a true crisis in terms of how we think about the ways that we work with young boys and men.
I'll take that. I'll accept it. But when it comes to things like CTE and college, I think we'll just need to study, like, why are girls having a better time of it then? Let's study it. Let's figure out what that is. We did talk a lot about getting, you know, young men and boys into more what used to be seen as feminized occupation, but you took a test years ago that said you should be a plumber. You know, my mom will tell you that when she was in school, she came home with a full schedule of band, home ec, and all this stuff, and my grandfather pitched a fit. He was like, who set up the schedule for you? And he marched her back to the school and talked to the counselor and was like, you are going to change this right now, right? Like, she is going to do, and you just fill in the blank with a bunch of things. Girls can't do math, you know, girls can't do this and whatever. And I think she learned a lesson out of that too, because she became very much a person like that. But, you know, there's probably girls right now that are actually not going to, they're not necessarily, listen, you go to rural areas, everybody's kind of having a little bit of pain right now. And yes, there probably are women that want to become plumbers maybe. And maybe you should have been a plumber, Kate. Like, you know, you never know. You might own a plumbing company right now.
There's still time.
There's still time for it all. My bottom line on all this is I really just think that like there's so much opportunity in the United States, but we're just mismatching. We just have people in the wrong places and there's not clear pathways for them to get what they need to become, you know, whole in a different occupation or do something different. So we just need to do better with the matching, the reducing friction, and the paying. That's the other thing. We just need to pay for stuff. Like it costs money for people to change careers, right? We sure, especially with teaching, we should probably offer some like big career bonuses to change. Like you get $10,000 to sign into the profession or something. Because if you don't, you're going to have a lot of talented people who are going to pass it up. So that's my final word. As always, we really appreciate you guys listening. And if you have made it all the way to this point at the end of the show, we really appreciate you. So what I'm going to ask you for at this point, if you want to help the show grow and move on, become bigger, we need you to actually rate the show wherever you listen to it and leave some remarks, leave a comment about the show that lets other people know why they should watch it or listen to it. And that's really, like, I've seen some great comments lately. We had a couple a week or so ago that made me really proud that we do this show. So please help us to get it to other people. And as always, we look forward to seeing you on the next episode of The Citizen Stewart Show. Thank you for listening. The Citizen Stewart Show is a production of the Branch Media Podcast Network. I'm Chris, Citizen Stewart. You can follow me at Citizen Stewart. You can follow Ravi at Ravi M. Gupta. You can follow all of The Branch's podcast at The Branch Media on YouTube, Twitter, Instagram, and TikTok. And check out our website at thebranchmedia.org. If you like what you hear, please leave us a review, give us a 5-star rating, and subscribe to the show so you can join us every Tuesday for more of The Citizen Stewart Show.